Welcome back, folks. It's Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, home of the Big 4-0 Birthday Bash, taking place this Saturday, January the 28th. More information at WEAA.org. So join us for the Big 4-0 party here in WEA. We want you to be there and be part of it. Well, this has been a momentous last 3 days or so. We've seen an inauguration on Friday, and then we saw these massive demonstrations that took place in D.C., in New York, in L.A., all across the United States. And as I posted, there was even a demonstration north of the Arctic Circle with Inuit brothers and sisters standing up at the very top of the world, which I found interesting. And then across the globe, in Accra, in Malawi, in South Africa, in Paris, in London, in Delhi. So it really was an amazing, amazing day. We're going to talk about that with folks who were there and hear about all of that. As well as the confrontations going on now between the new administration and the press, and questions of size. Size seems to be a big thing in their mind. So we are going to talk a bit about that as well and what that means. So please do join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. And you can also email us, or tweet us at Mark Steiner, but do join in, 410-319-8888. And I think, do we have State's Attorney online? Is she there? Yes, good, good. So I'm going to begin the show before you introduce all of our guests to Marilyn Mosby, who's our State's Attorney here in Baltimore City. Marilyn, welcome. Good to have you with us. Good morning.
Thank you for having me, Mark. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing well. Hanging in there.
Yeah. I'm sure. We'll talk about all that another day. But talk a bit about Saturday's march here in Baltimore. There's thousands showed up in the streets of Baltimore to go along with the Women's March in D.C. and New York and all across the globe. And you spoke. So talk a bit about that march, what happened here in Baltimore and the words you shared and why.
Well, I think it was a very important day. I mean, especially now with all the negativity that's happening in our world today, the racially divisive times in which we live, it was, you know, one of the things that I said was the power of women is beyond what anyone else could imagine. No one would have thought that more than 1 million women from all across this nation would unify and display such solidarity. And what we were displaying in that solidarity was against intolerance. Saturday was beautiful for a number of reasons, because you had mothers, you had sisters, daughters, and you had friends. You know, we were convening and demanding and forging a coalition of unification for social justice and change. It was pretty much a reminder to the world that we as women will not be berated, disrespected, objectified, or silenced. I was there because I have 2 little girls. And at the end of the day, we're not going away, because as I stated on Saturday, every great movement towards progress began with warrior women. We women are the backbones of our families and our communities. And when we look at public policy and politics, not just in Baltimore, but all across this nation, we're the ones that will decide that politics on the state and local and national level.
So what do you think this portends politically? I mean, in the next 4 years, here locally, nationally? I mean, this is an era we're going to see the potential end of ACA, if that does happen. It could mean billions of dollars to the state of Maryland. But beyond that, I mean, there's lots of political issues that we're facing. Women seem to be in the lead, which I think is a really powerful thing that's happening, this shift in America. What do you think it'll mean?
I mean, what my hope is that this display of solidarity will inspire activism. My hope is that as women will be inspired to continue the momentum to get and remain locally engaged, as you just mentioned. My hope is that we as women will be today what we were 50 years ago, which was the driving force and strategy, organization, and implementation of social, political, and economic equality in this country.
So, and how many people showed up in Baltimore, do you think? I heard up to 5,000. Do you have a sense of how many people were in the streets?
Yeah, it was a lot of women. We came out in full force. It was about 5,000 from what I read on Saturday.
I mean, that's pretty amazing to me. I mean, that I don't think I can ever remember a time where I've seen 5,000 people demonstrating in the streets of Baltimore. Maybe after Freddie Gray, when there was the massive demonstrations here after his death and demanding justice, we saw that in the streets of Baltimore. But beyond that, I don't remember anything that large in the city.
Well, it was all across the nation. I mean, more than 1 million women all across the nation stood up. And what we were standing up for, and what I said by warrior women. We showed the world that we were unafraid to rise up in the face of hatred. You have to rise up against racial, gender, religious, and ethnic intolerance, regardless of who or what the source of that intolerance may be.
State Senator Marilyn Mosby, it's always great to talk to you. I know you have a huge, busy day, and we'll get to our panel here in the studio. Thank you so much for taking your time with us here this morning, and it was great to see you out there Saturday morning, and your speech was fiery and focused, and I appreciate all that.
Well, thank you, Mark.
Take care. That was Marilyn Mosby, our state's attorney, who gave the keynote at the Baltimore demonstration. 5,000 here, 25,000 people in Pittsburgh, and we're not sure how many people really showed up in D.C., but if you look at the numbers, and I've looked at people calculating numbers, it could have been close to 1 million women in Washington alone. 750,000 people marched in Los Angeles. 500,000 people in New York City. Close to 90,000, maybe more, in Chicago. So big they had the people who ran the demonstration called it off, but the women stayed out and the people and their allies stayed out in the streets. So it was huge. And we're here with our guests. And let me introduce our guests here, two of whom were at the demonstration. Carla Wills, senior news producer at Democracy Now!, who's working and bringing that live feed in from Democracy Now! Good to have you in the studio once again.
Good
Carla,
to be back, yes.
Any excuse to get you in the studio when you're in BMOR? We do that.
Thank you.
Dr. Kate Trubinsky is here, lecturer of gender and women's studies and director of women involved in learning and leadership. Will, program at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Kate, always good to have you in the house.
Great to be here.
And I haven't had a chance to see it on the air, but congratulations on your wedding.
Thank you.
And we're here with the Reverend Kevin Slayton, pastor of the New Waverly United Methodist Church, president of the Interdenominational Ministerial Alliance of Metropolitan Baltimore, and an old friend. Good to have you here in the studio, Kevin.
Glad to be here, Mark.
Tom Moronic may be calling us as well, host of the Tom Moore Show, but I think he was called into court. He's a lawyer. Oh, you, Tom, you there?
I'm here.
Oh, we heard you went to court. Okay, but you're not. You're there. So 410
319-8888
is the number here to call in. You can email us at talk@steinershow.org, tweet us at Mark Steiner, jump onto our Facebook pages. So there's a lot. I want to get into some of the intensity around this march in a moment, some of the contradictory things I've seen on Facebook and the back and forth that I have involved in as well. But let me start, Carla, with you and go to Kate and then just get your sense of what that day was like. You were in the midst of it and what you think the political importance was.
Oh, it's extremely politically important. Of course, you know, all the movements are what make policy move forward in this country. And if there's any indication of what happened on Saturday, the low estimates of 3.6 million people around the country, upwards to, you know, more than 4 million, if you add it all up, showed up and, you know, voiced their concerns about this incoming administration, the policies that, you know, apparently will be on the table, up for consideration, threats to Planned Parenthood, the administration picks, like we're going to talk about soon, you know, Betsy DeVos and, you know, folks like that. It looks like this, if this translates into action after Saturday, then, you know, we will see some real, you know, movement forward and not allow this incoming administration to kind of have their way with, you know, what they're planning. But the question is, what happens after Saturday?
Which I want to get to. That's a really important question to see.
And apparently tomorrow there are more protests planned around the country against the swamp cabinet, so to speak. So we'll see what happens, you know, moving forward. And again, one of the other messages from Saturday was, you know, to be how you translate that, how people have to run, women have to run. We have to support women who run for office. And that's the other way, you know, this kind of stuff, this energy gets translated.
Kate?
So you asked what it was like to be there. And what it was like to be there for me was a huge crush of people. I waited 3.5 hours to get on a MARC train. I waited in a lot of different bathroom lines. I had to pee the whole time. It was really, it was...
Not laughing at you.
I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know if I was in the march yet or what was happening. And I think a lot of people had that experience. And it was also a feeling of complete elation. I had tears watching people streaming from all corners just to line up at Penn Station. And it was really exciting and inspiring. And it was also pretty messy. I mean, Mark didn't expect us to come, and I laughed about it because
Mark Train.
Mark Train. I mean, not you, Mark Steiner. You knew we were going, but I felt like the Mark Train and didn't expect us to come. And I thought to myself, so many women said they were coming, and people don't believe women. We came. They were surprised. But they did eventually run extra trains for us and get us all down there. And the messiness of it, I thought about that as I was thinking about it as a show of solidarity. Solidarity is a really hard, it's a practice, it's not a moment. And there was a lot of messiness at the march, and there will continue to be. But I think what it is for me is an opening, a huge opening for people who haven't been involved in politics. You know, my Aunt Marianne knitted herself one of those hats, and she went to the march in Seattle, and she's 70 years old, and she's never been to a march. And those people are here, and I am really excited about welcoming them in, finding places they can plug in to movements that are already happening, and I hope that happens. So, like Carla, I think the question is, what happens next? And I would, for me, I'm encouraging myself to remember that no one knows, and what happens next is what we make happen, and that's a project.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was the first time for many people. I think I know that Valerie was there with her best friend, my other half, and who had never been on a demonstration before, I think, if that's right, and in all of her years. And so many people were like that who were out there. And that's why this is interesting to me politically, about what this means for what is brewing in this country. I mean, this election to me, the entire election was about the divide in America, but this is something that's bubbling up. And Kevin, I know you had your event here in Baltimore. I know you weren't there, but...
Yeah, I did have an event, but I was, you couldn't miss it. I approached it from slightly different perspective, which can be summed up with surprise, to Kate's point. You know, you heard it, you heard about it, but you're still shocked about the numbers. And then the questions that originate for me, even in Kate's comments and yours about Valerie's friend, to be at this point and have not participated in protest begs the question for me as a society, have we become intrigued by protest? And so it's sort of what we become to do now as a society, is we find something to protest. And we don't necessarily know going in what the expectation is to come out on the other end, but we want to be a part. We want to be there. We have social media so we can capture the moment. And because we captured the moment, then it's history. We're a part of it. But the thought process and the expectation setting for what we get from this protest, I'm concerned about those elements of it. I think as an African-American male, to see women at that level protesting is very, very inspiring. It calls me to a greater action. But again, I'm just, because I've seen this stuff sort of play out before, you know, where do you go back to? And the word that comes for me is, I mean, I'm a big supporter of Michelle Alexander, and I'm rereading her book for a second time. And that first chapter, the word, I didn't realize she used it so much. It was written before the elections or even the primaries. The word backlash seems to be the new word that's coming up. And then Van Jones hits it, that the vote is a backlash. So I'm at the front of this protest, looking, saying, would this protest happen if it were not for a female losing an election or the rhetoric of a white male?
But that's exactly it, though, isn't it? That's what happens when, I think that when you have so much progress and push has been made in the last 60 years in this country or more, that this pushback is causing a resistance to the pushback. And I think that's something that is different about this period than other periods, Carla.
Yeah.
There's a resistance to the pushback that I've not seen in most of American history before.
But I think I understand the point you're getting at, too. It's about now who is feeling the effects. And a larger audience, particularly of white women, now feeling the effects of this administration harming them in ways that we've always felt harmed by, you know, in policies and things. Mm-hmm. And so now they're seeing, oh, we've got this president who is, you know, a misogynist, who is, you know, accused of all these things, who's threatening, you know, freedoms that we, you know, hold dear now. And then that combined with this Republican Congress is very scary. That proposition is scary. These are things that we as African Americans have had to navigate and understood, you know, for you know, decades. For centuries. And so now that white women are getting it, are starting to feel that threat, they are mobilized in ways that they weren't before. And the other thing, to your other point, protest is now the thing. And we're now, you know, kind of embracing it. But, you know, as Kate said, it's messy. And do people really understand how you know, to really kind of start to grapple with all the inner struggles? And, you know, you saw that on Saturday with, you know, there are African-American women, you know, who were saying, listen, you know, 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump. And now there are all these white women out here. And, you know, there was the, you know, the conversation over whether this was the Million Becky March kind of thing. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was so there is that to deal with, you know, the inner struggle between, you know, the whole intersectionality of what it means to be women and women of color and trans women. And, you know, all of that gets messy.
Yeah, I mean, so, and just in like the when I was talking about the embodiment of the march, one of the things I was thinking about is how many people wouldn't be able to attend this kind of protest, right? Anybody with kind of with disabilities that would keep them out. People had to work that day, you know, the people who were working to get the rest of us there. I mean, these movements are... they're always limited. And this question of what took you so long to get out here? I mean, access to healthcare has been bankrupting people across this country for as long as I can think of. So why is it right now that you're out here? And I think that raises for me a couple of questions. One, how do you teach radical empathy? How do you get people to see that things that they don't imagine affect them immediately matter to them? And they need to organize around those things, right? So rather than making it a stopping point, make it a starting point. Like, how do we make this leap? And then, secondly, how do we now invite these people in? What are the points of connection? And is it their job to find us, or is it our job to find them? Or how do we move forward?
Well, look, Tom, we haven't heard from you. Let you jump in here. Then we'll open the phones at 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on Saturday?
I think it was a tremendous day. I think that the points the other guests made about the solidarity, and let's keep in mind, this came from a woman from Hawaii who wrote after the election on social media that she thought there ought to be a march in Washington. And the day or so after, several days after, she had 10,000 likes. So that's how this comes about. And the other thing is Donald Trump had a tremendous opportunity to come out and try to anticipate this fervent march. He knew it was coming, and he could have taken the inauguration speech to try to bring the country together. Now, again, that would be a very difficult task for him, but he could have at least complimented President Obama, complimented Hillary Clinton on her service, and he didn't do any of those things, and instead talked about the things that he wants to change and basically appealed to his base. And I think, if anything, it fomented even greater anger amongst these protesters. Again, it was a peaceful protest, but again, one of the reasons that he won this presidency is because turnout didn't happen in the places that Hillary Clinton needed the turnout. And I think something like this could generate 4 years from now the type of turnout that would change the result next time.
So, you know, we have most of the marches in the past, let's say 1963, one of the ones that you can remember is one of the original huge marches in Washington, D.C. And that actually came out of a movement building towards something that pushed these 500,000 people to show up in Washington, D.C., with Martin Luther King and SNCC and the rest, John Lewis and everybody else. It had its limitations. Only one woman spoke. There were all kinds of other issues about that. But the reality is that was a movement that pushed that forward. So this is something a little different. I mean, this is some of the dynamic here, I think, says a lot about where this might lead. This was a protest that was built out of the frustration of Donald Trump becoming winning this election and Hillary losing this election. And it was fueled by that. And in the beginning, there was a lot of controversy. over the women who organized it and used the word
Million Women's March,
which people thought was usurping the language that was a Million Women's March in
97.
You gotta know your history.
And then as I've gone back and forth arguing with people about this and discussing it, is that the saying, like with Bernie Sanders, when Bernie Sanders was confronted by Black Lives Matter during the primary, he backed up and stopped and went, well, what am I missing here? And actually learned from that process and broadened his campaign in ways that didn't start that way. The same way I think the women who organized this march in the beginning had to stop and go, what? And then other women came in who were women of color, Black women, other women of color, to kind of take the lead in pushing. I think you saw that writ large in terms of who was on the podium and what people had to say. So the question is, where does that go from here? Does this momentum build locally so that there's movements across the country that are actually building to change? Do people actually feel it? 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump, but that means 47% of white women did not vote for Donald Trump, which is also a huge number of people in a politically radical struggle saying, no, we're not voting for this man. So something's shifting in America. The question is, where does
I think the emotion does take this post-March? The emotion and the concern that sort of pushed women there now has to be undergirded by some really orchestrated organizing at each individual state level, I think. One of the benefits of the 1963 march was there were some things in place. So you went back to Alabama, Kentucky, wherever you went to, and you had a local chapter of the NAACP, had an urban league, had all these different things that you could plug into. And you didn't have to start from this infantile place of trying to figure out, well, what is this organization about? You know, why should I join it? Why should I be a part of it? You know, who are going to be the voices to sort of say those things and establish it? As I was watching some of the commentary again on Facebook and other areas, trying to figure out, okay, now who becomes the face? That's a part of the question. Who is the face for this, and sort of gives, you know, folks need somebody to look to and sort of say, who is this? Where are we going next? What do we do? Who is that? Mm. What does that face look like?
Mm. Well, apparently,
but it's also the message too. Mm. I mean, I think it's mobilization and message. I think you have to also understand, yes, organize at the local levels, but you've got to focus on a message that's broad enough to hit the core issues that people marched about on Saturday, but also a message that reaches out to the working class voters who voted no to Hillary and voted yes to Obama. So I think you got to win those back by also broadening your message enough to be able to reach them as well.
And my question is broadening that message, I mean, this, of course, Saturday was a women's march, but we're really not just talking about women. We're really talking more about progressive issues because, you know, one of the things I heard, as this was being organized, were women who were, you know, pro-life, women who were, you know, Trump supporters, women who were just, you know, who felt like, you know, I'm not included in this. Conservative women weren't included in this. And so, you know, we have to kind of define really what this is. And so if it's not necessarily just a women's movement and it's a more broader progressive movement, then maybe it's about women leading that progressive movement, but not necessarily it being a women's movement. You know, so we have to really, so the face, you know, and the messaging really is important. And of course, as you said, the, you know, the local organizing, I think, is what's important as well, because people are like, how do we go back and then do, you know, it translate this at home? I know, you know, Reverend William Barber has been a leader in the progressive
Moral
movement
Mondays.
In North Carolina. Yeah, in Moral Mondays. And what they've done is, you know, and one of his messages is that these things change in state houses and in governorships and, you know, around the country. And what they've been able to do in North Carolina, as conservative a state as it is, they've been able to get a Democratic governor. Of course, he's got his issues because the outgoing Republican governor tried to change some laws at the last minute to limit his power. But they've got a Democratic governor. They've got their Fight for 15 is moved forward. There's a lot of progress going on in North Carolina, and that's because they've really focused the energy statewide. And so this progressive movement, whether it's women-led or whatever, and that kind of helps define the messaging. That I think what Saturday was about, let's show what happens when women lead this larger movement.
Yeah, and that local organizing, I think the way this march was organized makes so many openings for that. I'm thinking my stepmom lives in a tiny little mountain town in Idaho called McCall. And 200 people showed up, and it was organized in 24 hours. And those 200 people now know each other. They live in a tiny town. I don't know what's going to happen with it, but I'm guessing 15 or 20 of those people are going to stay in contact and try to organize around the issues that matter in their communities. Because one thing about this kind of a national movement is that we don't all want the same things.
Right.
We will never all be on the same page. Sometimes what I want, if you get what you want, I don't get what I want. And that's like a truth about politics, is that it is really, really messy. And so I hope that we can stay flexible for people to organize. You know, all those women took 15 hours on the bus to get home. Who knows what they decided they needed where they are? I actually don't know what other people need, right? So I'm hoping that that organizing on the local level continues.
We have to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to look at we're going to get to the calls. Eric and Malik, you're the first two callers up. We're going to look at the rest of this Trump presidency and what this march might mean in terms of organizing and where this may take us. Some tweets have come in on the way out. Let me just share some of these tweets that came in. One of the tweets came in from La Vida Buena, who tweeted in at Mark Steiner here, "Keep punching Nazis until at New York Times puts it on the front page." So that was a thing that came out where this one Nazi was hit in the face. The guy ran after that. Of course, I have my issues with that, but that's another reason. Mm-hmm. Not hitting Nazis, but why, how it happened. We'll be right back and we'll continue this. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. And we also have Melissa, who tweeted in, "Organizing at local level is key," capital letters. "Slate legislator does redistricting. Without Voting Rights Act, we need deeper local bench to protect rights." Also tweeted in here, "Community activists should look to central community," I guess that means, COM, "and to try to take seats that
Central Committee.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Central Committee, and to try to take seats there to make the more progressive, support progressive candidates." All right. Thank you, Melissa, for those tweets.
That's a good point.
It is a good point.
Yeah. I mean, we just saw what the State Central Committee is a body that nobody really pays attention to until they become important, like they just were in replacing Jill Carter's seat. And of course, there was here an effort to get Davon Love to take that seat. Of course, that didn't happen, but that's the State Central Committee.
That's always amazing to me to hear those conversations after, too. Mm-hmm. It's a political apparatus. And then it always amazes me that the people who are in politics are amazed at the level of politics that took place in it.
In it, yeah.
Like, that's the reason it's there.
Not to get stuck in the state, conversation, but
that's a whole other conversation.
But it is. And they are a very, so I said to somebody today, there have always been political animals run by the political machine. There's nothing new. This is how it works in Baltimore and most other cities in America, it's where local politics really is.
But that's one of the ways to translate the energy of this movement, getting on those committees.
So where does this take us, do you think? I mean, when you look at what is ahead, and then we open the phones after this commentary here, I mean, you've got all these people being put in places in the new administration. We don't know if she'll get it or not, but Betsy DeVos, is that Betsy, right?
Betsy DeVos,
right, who is for privatization of all of our schools. We're seeing she will probably get the secretaryship, is my guess. You've got folks in charge of, you've got our attorney general who is against voting rights and thinks it's an intrusion. And you know you'll see no more consent decrees. They have not finished the Freddie Gray or many other investigations here. The DOJ will probably stop those investigations once he comes into office. Right? That's probably going to happen. You've got people heading the APA who doesn't even think the organization should exist. And that climate change is a joke, so that you've got now India and China taking the lead over from the United States internationally, whether you agree that it's not going fast enough or not. I'm just talking very establishment sense here. So when you look at these millions of people who showed up in America yesterday, and we don't know the exact numbers, but they could be a million, as some people say, could be close to 4 million. We other people say, I just don't know the exact numbers, but whatever, there's a lot of energy there. So what does that mean in terms of what is going to happen next year? Where do you think this takes us?
And of course, this is this cabinet coming in is going to be comprised of the most billionaires ever to occupy a cabinet. I saw one of those memes on Facebook. It's like, you really think, this you know, this bunch of billionaires is going to, you know, come up or try to tackle the systems that made them billionaires in the first place, you know, on behalf of people. It doesn't even make any kind of sense, not to mention the conflicts of interest of all of these people coming in and you know, the waiting for, you know, the disclosures, the questionnaires. I mean, it is just... it is a disaster waiting to happen. You know, we're looking at who knows how many, you know, potential lawsuits and conflicts, and I don't know how many of these people will be able to keep their jobs if they're confirmed. They're, and likely most of them will be. It's probably not going to, you know, bode well for them. And of course, Betsy DeVos. I mean, this is a woman who's never really seen the inside of a public school classroom. So, you know, it boggles my mind.
And couldn't answer the simplest questions during her hearing.
And couldn't answer the simplest questions. I mean, and so most of these people don't care anything about the departments that they're going to be running. Of Rex Tillerson, you know, we know the history of Exxon and their role in climate change. And of course, decades ago, they were at the forefront, you know, in conducting experiments. And then, you know, they tried to hide all this data because it wasn't benefiting them. And so, you know, it's unbelievable how people thought the idea of who is the president really doesn't matter. This is what we heard prior to the election. Oh, Trump, Hillary, doesn't matter, won't make a difference. And it's like, I'm hoping people are really paying attention to see how this one decision and how this person has an effect on all of these other, you know, policies and how things move forward. It's not just the president. It's his cabinet. It's the court. It's all of it.
But from my spiritual perspective, certain places we never get to in our lives unless there is some challenge. I'm seeing good things coming from it. The unity that it has forced us into. The spaces in which we are now considering the marginalized and the poor from different places that we didn't consider them 8 months ago. We are now, as a people, beginning to see in all of our brothers and sisters, whether they're in rural America, in urban America, all in need and aspiring of the same qualities of life. And this person that will now lead this country has forced us all to look in the mirror and see ourselves. So if nothing else, that is a good thing. What will we now do with it? To Mark's question is the question.
Yeah, and I would, and none of, you know, it is, Trump is, I think, he is a new thing, but these problems are not new. People have been organizing against the privatization of public schools for decades and decades and decades. I mean, here in Baltimore and in Maryland, fighting about charter school laws and weakening of teachers' unions, it's an ongoing struggle. So climate change is not like, 2 months ago, the United States was really like working to solve this problem. I mean, so I think that thinking about what do we do going forward, part of it is looking to people who've already been doing this work and asking them what they need. How can we support them? And that's just sort of my first thought about where we go. Ask people who've already been working on this stuff.
And I think
but the other thing...
Go ahead, Tom.
I was going to say the other thing is we do have to find issues where we can work with the administration and try to accomplish some things. Like one issue is on trucks. I think it's very simple, and Bernie Sanders has pushed this for a long time, that Americans ought to be able to get affordable pharmaceutical drugs. And this is an issue that Trump has said he will support. Al Franken has come out that he really hopes this will happen. And not all of his nominees were awful. I think Mike Pompeo is very good. I think General Mattis came out very strong. But the problem is just the other nominees and some of the other policies have been put forth are just so extreme. And that's the issue. It's going to be hard to find that common ground. But I think, you know, where do we go from here? We try to find issues where we can work with them.
Well, I'm not so sanguine about people like Pompeo who supported torture and more.
I couldn't believe yesterday hearing people having an actual conversation about whether or not waterboarding is okay. I mean, I can't believe we're still talking about that. That is torture. That is never okay. Some of these conversations I can't believe we're having. To have a military man and a civilian.
He walked it back and said his comments were misinterpreted. I mean, Democrats who supported him said, I mean, like Claire McCaskill have come out and said they're going to give him the benefit of the doubt. That's my position. Obviously, supporting torture is extreme, so I guess he handled it well, but absolutely agree. If that's something he supports, that's not good.
But, you know, this is the complexity of, I'm going to open the phones here. This is the complexity of Donald Trump and his presidency, because Donald Trump is not a right-wing conservative. He is much more of a economic nationalist. That's so you're going to see a lot of things he says that sound like they are like for the majority of the people, but his misogyny and his racism make that lean towards a very kind of right wing agenda. Even though some of the stuff he says is not necessarily like typical conservative politics, so he might say things about the drug, having drugs being able to come in from Canada, which is great. But then it's interesting to watch how many Democrats voted against that, who are tied to the pharmaceutical industry, including Senator Booker and others, right? So I think you're going to see a lot of contradictions erupting here within the Democratic Party and outside in the community organizing. That's why I think it's going to be a very volatile 4 years, and none of us have this crystal ball that can say where this is going to bounce out.
Like I like to say, there's no clean living in capitalism. I mean, it's going to be a struggle. We're going to contradict ourselves and each other.
Let me get to the phones. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts. 4 years. Eric, you're on the air. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Mr. Steiner and your panel. Quick question. The social issues that we're dealing with, particularly in America, I wonder from you, your panel, and any listening, any people that may call us in the listening audience, the way that this country was established, it was taken, tricked, whatever, from the native people that were here, and then a whole nation of people was brought here to build the country. And then now everybody that's here has all of these different types of issues, but nobody wants to deal with the original issues of why this place that we're in, the very ground that you and I stand on, was taken from us. Like, we kind of ignore those issues, I think, and then kind of get mixed up in what becomes important to everybody else, you know, whether it's racism, you know, classism, sexism, materialism, and all of these other issues. I think we need to start at the beginning. We'll probably get some better results. Thank you.
I'm throwing there that people can comment really quickly on this before we go to the next caller. But I think that we have to understand our history, is how I put it. We have to understand our history.
We have to understand Reconstruction, what it was and why it failed.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, and of course there are people who have, you know, Condoleezza Rice famously said, and it was, you know, kind of rebroadcast when she said, you know, the country's original sin being slavery, and, you know, and it was like interesting that this Republican woman said that. Though to me, the original sin isn't slavery. The original sin is what happened to the native peoples here in this country when you know, the colonists came and destroyed, took their land, you know, killed, you know, hundreds of thousands of native people. So there are so many sins upon which this country is founded. I get this caller's point, because those, you know, as long as we're just kind of still building on that without really dealing with those issues, you know, we've got a really shaky foundation.
And I think it's interesting. I think if we built a politics on attempting to make better those sins, it would be interesting, right, to think about what would it mean to give up the personal property, right, that happens in that settler colonial moment that continues. Like, what would the world look like if we actually made good on that wrong? What would happen if we actually had a politics of reparations where we actually did something to actually make better those kinds of sins? Mm-hmm. I think the world that would build out of that would be really different from this one. It's a very different project from calling your senator to ask him not to vote for Betsy DeVos. So I think thinking about working at multiple levels is going to be really important.
I have to keep stressing the need to broaden the tent, because reparations are incredibly divisive. If you're going to talk reparations, you really have to go back to the very beginnings of this country. I mean, literally half of the country is going to be giving back land. I don't support reparations for those reasons. However, what I do say is we need to have a party that has an open door to people who say they feel that they've not had their rights respected for years and years, and who feel that there's inequalities, like the wage gap between men and women right now is just outrageous. And that's one of the things that so many people were marching on Saturday. And I think we need to say this is a key issue. This is something that is just a basic innate right to be an American, that everyone deserves to be paid the same thing. And I think if we keep that tent broad, we'll be able to get there.
I think that's one of the difficulties we're going to face, because there's so much here. I'm going to go to the phones right here, but there's so much here that is bubbling up under the surface.
It can become very explosive at any moment.
Very explosive at any moment. I mean, any moment.
You have to be able to work on multiple scales. You can't, because you can broaden that tent, and then people are like, well, I'm not in that tent anymore, and they're going to organize somewhere else. So for me, a model of coalitional politics, do we want this thing together at the same time? Yeah, a bunch of people can be brought together around the wage gap, you know. But we have to be flexible.
Well, yeah, but, you know, as you said, no clean politics in a capitalistic society, and that's kind of where it all ends up. You know, you made a point earlier that, you know, there's always like this give and take, my rights over, you know, somebody mm-hmm. else's rights. And when you're talking about, I mean, at the end of the day, we're all talking human rights. What I find is the kind of foundational here is that human rights always butts up against capitalism. Mm-hmm. So if we're talking about wage equality or any other kind of, you know, parity, equality, it is, well, is this going to harm this particular capitalist structure? You know, the corporate structure or whatever, you know, how much do they have to give up for these folks to have their rights?
Yeah, as my friend Ruthie Gilmore would say, you know, capitalism requires inequality and racism enshrines it.
And it's all, let me go back to the phone, unless you want to jump in real fast. I think this also has to do with the subtleties that kind of make things bubble to the surface. You know, when we talk about race and the conscience of racism in America, when we use like word, the people, little things, but they say a lot. When we say the word working class in this election, we mean white working class. We never say white working class. We say working class as if black and brown folks were not in a working class, right? Mm-hmm. The other morning on NPR, I'm listening to Morning Edition, and they're talking about last year's shows that were made all the hits in television. A lot of them were pushed by around black. Black creative people and black folks on the screen, but now it's women. But what they didn't say was that all those shows were about white women, mm-hmm. not about mm-hmm. women. So it's, we have to really understand when we have these language things in our head, that fuels, that shows how deep it is.
Yeah.
And we have to really wrestle with, honestly, what those things mean to confront that, to be able to change it, to want to build something that's broader. And that, to me, in a sense, is a form of reparations.
Absolutely. And a lot of those black shows led by creative people were black women, you know, so there's that right. as well.
So let me go to the phones here. Let's go back to Malik. You've been holding on for a bit. Welcome.
Hey, thank you, man. I just want to say it was a blessing to me to see the women mobilizing. And I'm proud to say that the person I voted for, it makes me even more proud that I voted for her, because even though she didn't win, she preached a lot of this a year or so ago, and she inspired me to become more active in my community, become an education advocate. I'm still doing that. But what I think is, that just like you said, a lot of you really helped me to understand things more broadly. And it is, you know, I think I learned from your show. I learned a lot from your show, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, and one of the things I learned is that you have to start at the local level. But a lot of issues we have in Baltimore City has nothing to do with Donald Trump. You know, I mean, you focus on all your anger and energy towards Donald Trump, but yet my kids go to school and I'm in the process of fighting for them to have a good class size. I mean, you know, it's a lot. I can't transfer my kids out of Baltimore. You can't always run away. Sometimes you got to fight, but I'm definitely motivated by these strong women. And I think with Donald Trump winning, it's going to wake people up. And men, I'm taking charge of my community now. I'm glad to see the sisters are doing that too. I actually worked Uber, and I actually was fortunate enough to meet not just women, but men, drive a few people where they need to go. So I was real grateful to be a part of that in my own way.
Well, thanks for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Malik. Thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, you know, and I think that you're right. And we're going to be talking about that in the next hour a bunch, which is that what happens locally in our schools. Because, Malik, you, as many citizens who deeply care about their children, can't afford to write a check to send your kids to a private school. So that is an issue. Mm-hmm. So, and our children are our future. And when you watch your babies going to places where they're not being really educate and taken care of, I mean, that should make citizens rise up as an organizing point for change, because it's just an obscenity what we allow to have happen to
our
children.
You know, and I was at an event Saturday night and saw Dee Watkins there, and he was just talking about the fact that, you know, his last couple of books, The B-Side and The Cook-Up, were like the kids, when they get their hands on them, those kids, they devour those books. They love those books. They speak to them. And he's trying to get them in schools here and can't do it. So, you know, he feels like it's like they want these kids to fail. They don't want them to have access to the books that speak to them, that are going to want to make them readers, that are going to want to make them learners. And so we have to look at, you know, what are the bureaucratic kind of stuff that we have to fight through in order to, you know, get the stuff to our kids that's really going to make them excited about learning. We put all these, like, you know, gates in the way so that we can't just make things happen for our kids.
Not gates, they're people.
Well, people.
Right.
People are standing in the way.
Yeah.
I think Malik makes a great point also about, like, work on the issue that is affecting you where you are, right? There's so many things to do. So some people are like, oh, the problems are so big, I can't do anything. Well, pick the thing that you think is really important and work on that, right? If everybody flaps their wings in the general direction of the world we think we want, we will collectively get closer to it.
So but let me ask this question for you, then we'll try to get back to the phones here and get a call in here before it's up. Let me go to the... Let me just ask this question and get right back to phones. I mean, what was the town you said your family came from?
McCall,
so,
Idaho.
Where 200 people showed up, right?
Yep.
So It's Idaho. I mean, and so, but you've got here 5,000 people showed up in Baltimore and 25,000 in Pittsburgh. The question is that the local struggles are important. That's what fuels the change. But what connects McCall to Baltimore, to Chicago, to Santa Fe, New Mexico, to the Inuit people, the several dozen Inuit people who stood up in the sub-zero temperatures of the Arctic Circle. What connects them? How does that get connected?
I think therein lies your problem for the movement, is those folks sitting around and sort of figuring out, because at that point you're at a numbers game again. How many support this issue being what we put our energies in versus those of us doing this? And throughout history, whenever groups organize to do that, and they feel their voice is not the one that's rising to the top, some type of schism occurs, and then there's an offshoot of that, an offshoot of that. And again, I think it's important that they really get a handle on, I think there has to be some type of leadership created around it to sort of help them muddle through that type of, if not, it's going to explode, and it's going to explode a lot faster than we think.
Well, you know, of course, the newer model is to kind of have these leaderless, you know, movements. And I don't know, I mean, you know, look at Occupy and look at, you know, Black Lives Matter. A lot of times it's like intentional to make it, you know, a more, you know, kind of just people working together. There's no true leader, and
where is Occupy now?
Yeah, exactly.
It changed the conversation,
but it changed the policy, and that's, you know, we're having a lot of conversations. Yeah. So now we got to move beyond conversations to, you know, making things happen. And I don't know, I don't know that I'm on the side of necessarily a leader, but, you know, I'm open to that conversation too.
But then here, I mean, historically, I mean, and I, you know, I don't like things that are always top down. However, leaders come up from the bottom. I mean, King became a leader because of the Montgomery bus boycott and the churches that pushed him up to the top in that leadership. You know, Malcolm came from everybody can think of came from a place below. And sometimes you do need that symbolic thing, personage that people flock around, and that is real. It's like a, you know, we have this thing about everything can be leaderless, but what is that? I'm not sure that's real.
Somebody's got to set the time of the meeting. I run a leaderless student group, and you know what? We like have assigned tasks. I don't know. I mean, I think I would encourage myself anyway to think of this as a long game. Like, we don't actually know what's going to happen or which leaders are going to rise. Will the women who stepped in and took over the organization of this women's march, are they going to be the leaders? Is Angela Davis going to be the leader? Is it going to be one of the leaders? Who's going to sort of step into those gaps? Is it going to be local leaders, something else? And we we can't expect a, at least I don't think we can expect a sort of an instant change in things like policy or ideology. Like, this is a long game that's going to be super messy.
So let me try to
use that 100%. Yeah, I think that you have a few leaders who are out there. Kamala Harris out of Los Angeles. I think she came out with looked very, very good in her leadership. And then obviously Bernie Sanders. There's a lot of people who agree with what Bernie Sanders has been supporting, the climate change that Mark mentioned, and obviously the wage equality we've been talking about. Leaders like that are going to stand up and keep fighting, and I think that's the type of thing you need to have. You know, make sure your views are espoused by those leaders so that they can stand up in places where they pass laws and say something.
And at the top of the next hour, we're going to hear one of those future leaders for the first couple of minutes of the program, which is young Sophie Cruz, who spoke at the march.
She's so cute.
Her voice was amazing. She we're going to hear beautiful. That voice leading on the next hour. We have time. Let's try to get a couple quick callers in here. Let's go to Bernadette. You're on the air. Hi, Bernadette. You there? Bernadette, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Yes, I just called in because I wanted to respond to the caller that was making a comment about it's not so important who's in Washington. Well, I think he needs to reflect on the fact that it is important. We have to keep our eyes on both the local and the national, because he was talking about his child's school. Well, look who Trump has put up for head of education in his cabinet, a person who is not really that in tune with the public school situation. That's the only thing I'm.
I'm glad you said it, Burnett. That is very critical. And we stay tuned for the next hour. We're going to be wrestling with some of that stuff. Lizzie, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Lizzie.
Conversation.
Thank you.
So the thought that came to me listening to all of you guys speak is that what we need is a vision of what America and what the world should be. Our founding fathers, everybody loves referring to them. They were white men of property, but they had a vision. And it's because of having a vision that they were able to take steps towards that vision. And I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind is all these different action steps. You know, where do they lead? What principles are they based on? What's the vision? So when Donald Trump wants to privatize everything, what's the end point of that? What happens when you privatize everything versus federal regulation? What's the end point of having federal regulation in place? Another example would be racism and degradation. You know, what's the end point of acting like that versus the love and hope and unity that came up in the that came up yesterday? What's the end vision? Where are we trying to get to? I was in D.C. It was exhilarating. And to me, it wasn't about Trump. It was the fact that Trump epitomizes all and will take to an extreme all of these terrible steps that will take us to what he sees as the end point, which is money, 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 power, power, power. So I just think we need, as we talk about what's wrong, and as we try to obstruct all of these things, I go back to Malik and what he said about Baltimore. Baltimore's been devastated for a long time. What's our vision of Baltimore? And then what are the action steps necessary to get there? And a lot of us know what the action steps are, but I just think articulating a vision is so important, like that adorable little Sophie Cruz that did yesterday, and Kamala Harris, and, you know, Bernie Sanders, all different people have done that. So that's all I have to say.
Lizzie, thank you. I'm glad you helped us conclude our program. We have like maybe 30 seconds. Quick thoughts?
Yeah, that speaks a little bit, again, to the need for leadership. I mean, and that's the other thing. Visionary leadership, I think, might be the way to go and to help kind of channel all of this energy. But what we saw Saturday was just phenomenal, and we're hoping that it continues.
My last thought is just let's be patient and generous with each other. We're all going to screw up a lot in the next, you know, just as we've been doing. And so we got to be real patient because this is really hard work and none of us know where we're going.
Yeah, so conclude by saying the world is watching.
Yep.
And we have to take a short break. And I'm going to thank our guest. This is the great Reverend Kevin Slayton, who remains with us the next hour as we go local. And Dr. Kate Trubinsky, always good to have you in the studio,
thank
Kate.
You.
And my dear friend, Carla Wilson, thank you so much for joining us here in the house.
It's good to be here.
And Tom Mronick, who was with us earlier, thank you all. We are going to bring it local. We're going to talk about these budget cuts and more, but we're going to open the next hour with a young woman we've been talking about, Sophie Cruz, to hear the power and passion she left with the women and men who were in Washington, D.C. on Saturday. Stay with us. We'll be right back.